You know, as we come to Passover and Unleavened Bread each year, many of us review the gospel accounts. We go through the information that God has recorded in His Word about Jesus Christ. In particular, we tend to focus on the final days of Jesus Christ in this flesh. As I was going back through the story this year, I was struck by how much of the story modern Christianity has wrong. In the same way that they don't get the story right about Christ's birth, they don't get the story right about His death. And it kind of struck me as interesting to notice that both ends of His life in the flesh really are viewed in ways that don't really square with exactly what we find in the Bible. So today I would like to review those final events, really that final week of Christ's life in the flesh. I know that many of us, if I look out of the audience, many of you have been through this many years in your life and been through many Passovers. But it seems that every time I do this, I end up discovering something. I end up seeing something that I didn't see before, or I read something that maybe I had known before, but I forgot it. It's kind of drifted away. And I'm reminded of things, and it has kind of slipped from my focus. So I hope that'll be the case for you today as I go through this as well, as we go through this together. Now, in terms of the timing of that final week, I'll just mention that I'll primarily use A.T. Robertson's Harmony of the Gospel. That's the same book that Mr. Dick Thompson used in the Gospels FI Online class when he went through that. So I'll be using basically that same outline from Robertson's. Actually, I'll start with his part, what he labels part 11, and he has a title to that. It says, The Last Public Ministry in Jerusalem. And it really has to do with that final week of his life. Now, we have that final week beginning actually in John chapter 11, so I'd like to start there because we get a little bit of a dating of when this is from John's writing. And we can see the timing at the very first part of chapter 12, but I'd like to start at the end of chapter 11 because it kind of leads up to that. So John 11 and verse 55, it says, "And the Passover of the Jews was near." Now that can be a general term. We use the word near. And in terms of near, we know that's a little bit of a relative term. We sometimes think of things that are near and they're right next to our nose, but an airplane that's within 50 feet of each other flying different directions, that's 50 feet is that's catastrophic. That's not near. That is on top of each other. So near is a little bit farther away. Near is a general term, let's just say. It's a general term. Yes, it's near, but it doesn't nail it down. We find that in a couple of verses later. So it says, "The Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves." So we get the picture that it's within a few days at least, a week or so, because people are beginning to travel to Jerusalem already for this festival that it was one of the three pilgrimages that the Jews would do or that the Israelites would do each year. They would go to Jerusalem for the spring holy days for Passover and Unleavened Bread. They would come again for Pentecost in the summer, and then they would come at the end of the year for the fall festivals. So they're beginning to come, getting ready for the Passover. And verse 56 says, "Then they sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple." What do you think? That he will not come to the feast? And of course, the implied answer is no. We don't think he'll show up. Because verse 57 gives us the idea of why people might be thinking this. It says, "Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was," speaking of Jesus, "he should report it, that they might seize him." So it was pretty well known among the population, apparently, that they were looking to seize Jesus because they wanted to know where he was. If anyone sees him, tell us where he is and we will come capture him. We will come take him captive. So now we see verse 1 of chapter 12, and it tells us more specifically what the timing was. It says, "Then, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he raised from the dead." So now we're 6 days before Passover. So this gives us a more definitive timing rather than just the general near. Now it's 6 days before Passover. As best we can determine, this was AD 31. Passover in that year was on a Wednesday, and 6 days prior to that would make this a Thursday. So the week before he is killed, this is on Thursday, that this event takes place. And he comes and it says in verse 2, there they made him a supper. Martha served, but Lazarus was one who sat at the table with him. So he had a meal, spent the night there with them, apparently with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And while he was sitting at supper, John, in, I won't read all of this, but John makes the point in chapter 12 that Mary anointed his feet with this costly oil. Now we'll come back to this a little bit later, but this gives us the setting that this was said, that there was going to be for his burial, that he was telling them it was going to come soon. And we find an indication at the end of this passage that Judas was going to betray him. Verse 4 says, "But one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, 'Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?' This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it." Now, this is the first indication we have that Judas was not what he seemed to be, and that he was going to be the one to betray Jesus in John's account. Judas must have been deemed trustworthy, a trustworthy individual, because he was entrusted with the money for the group. He was given that responsibility. He was given that job. And now we're told that, well, in hindsight, he really wasn't a person for the job because he was a thief. He was taking the money. He proved to be a thief and a betrayer. We know that there was quite a crowd around. Pick it up in verse 9. It says, "Now a great many of the Jews knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only." I mean, they did want to see Jesus, but it wasn't for his sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. I mean, that was quite a stir. If you think about this, somebody had been dead for 3 days, and he comes out of the grave, and he's alive and well and healthy. That was quite an accomplishment, and so they were interested in seeing him as well. Verse 10, "But the chief priests plotted to put Lazarus to death also, because on account of him, many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus." So we find the chief priests, which, from what I understand, was primarily the Sadducees. They were the priesthood, or comprised most of the priesthood. They were not happy with this. They were looking for ways to kill both Jesus and Lazarus. They wanted to get rid of them both. And verse 12, "The next day, a great multitude that had come to the feast, when they heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem..." I'm going to pause here for a moment and say this is the day after Thursday, right? And the day that comes after that Thursday would be Friday. So here is Friday, and they learn that he's going to be coming to Jerusalem. He is in Bethany, but it's very clear that he is coming to Jerusalem. And so they want to go out to meet him. Now, John does not record the instructions Jesus gave to two of the disciples about finding him a way into Jerusalem. And by that, I mean finding him a donkey to ride on into Jerusalem. Jesus knew the way, and it wasn't that he needed somebody to guide him, but he knew that there was supposed to be a donkey that he was supposed to ride into Jerusalem. I'd like to pick it up in Matthew's account, Matthew 21. The other three gospel writers say this. John does not. You can hold your place here, because we will be back to John chapter 12. But let's go to Matthew 21 and note what we find here. Matthew chapter 21 and verse 1. It says, "Now when they drew near Jerusalem and came to Bethphage at the Mount of Olives, then Jesus sent two disciples." Now I'm going to pause here for a second. It says Bethphage, but it does not mention Bethany. But if you look at the other accounts, if you look at Mark and you look at Luke's account, you'll see that both Mark and Luke mention Bethphage and Bethany. He mentioned both of them, so they were obviously right there next to each other, two small little towns on the Mount of Olives, or right at the Mount of Olives. So Matthew only mentions the one, but it's very clear that it's the same location. So he sends two disciples, saying to them, "Go into the village opposite you, and immediately you will find a donkey tied and a colt with her. Loose them and bring them to me. And if anyone asks anything of you, you shall say, 'The Lord has need of them.' And immediately he will send them." That's all you need to say. And the owner will simply say, "Fine, go right ahead." That's kind of interesting, isn't it? He knew what that owner was going to say. He knew that if the owner questioned it, all they had to say was, "The Lord needs him." And the owner would say, "Well, okay, go ahead." It's interesting that Jesus realized what was going to happen and prophesied that. And of course, it did come true. And what follows is that Jesus enters Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, riding from the east, the Mount of Olives of east of Jerusalem. And he's riding on this donkey, which fulfills prophecies in Isaiah 62 and in Zechariah 9. You probably have marginal references for that. My Bible does. In the center margin, it tells you exactly where to find those prophecies and that this fulfilled those prophecies. And we, as you read that story or you read that account, people took their clothes, their outer garments, and they laid them on the donkey for Jesus to sit on, and some of them spread them on the path for him to ride his donkey across on. Now, to us, that sounds kind of strange. Why would you lay out your outer garment for somebody to ride on a donkey? Donkeys have, well, we won't go there, but can get cut, can get torn, can get soiled. I mean, there are all kinds of things that could happen to these garments, but people laid their garments out. In fact, if we went back to John's account, we would say that we would read that he says they were even waving palm branches, a symbol of victory. And some of these things seem to indicate a celebration or recognition of someone of royalty. And of course, Jesus was royalty. He was the king of the kingdom of God. He was a representative of that kingdom on earth at that time. Now, he was not going to take the throne and rule yet. He was not going to establish the kingdom, but he certainly is the king and was the king of that kingdom. Now, modern Christianity tells us this triumphant entry was on Sunday. And there is a ceremony quite often in the Catholic Church and perhaps others that talk about this Sunday entry into Jerusalem. But what we've seen from John's account of this, and if this was in AD 31, which our best recollection is that it's about that time, 30 or 31, probably 31, it was not on Sunday, it was the day after Thursday, which is Friday. And sometimes that triumphant entry is used to elevate Sunday to say, well, this is a day of worship, this is a day of greatness, this is a day of praise. Well, it wasn't that day when Jesus came into Jerusalem. It was on a Friday. It was a day leading up to the weekly Sabbath. In verse 19, we find that, back to John chapter 12. If we skip back there, we see that he's riding on this donkey, and verse 12 of John chapter 12 tells this same story of him coming into Jerusalem. But if we skip down to verse 19, notice what it says about Jesus riding into Jerusalem. People met him because they had heard of what he had done. In verse 19, the Pharisees therefore said among themselves, we read earlier it was the high priests. It was a priesthood, basically the Sadducees. Now in verse 19, the Pharisees therefore said among themselves, you see that you accomplish nothing. Look, the world has gone after it. You Sadducees can't get the job done. Look, even trying to capture Lazarus, you can't even get him and kill him. You certainly are not killing the Christ. In fact, more people are coming to him because of Lazarus. He's riding into Jerusalem and now all these people are giving him this adulation. You're not accomplishing anything. You're doing nothing. They're very upset by this adulation and him riding in and seeming that the chief priests are unable to do anything. Now, at this point in John chapter 12, we find that John begins to record another incident. And in this incident, there's a voice from heaven that comes and speaks to Jesus and says, you know, I'm pleased with you and something along those lines. But it doesn't, the other gospel writers don't do that. And then John goes into the final Passover in chapter 13. But John skips over some things that the other gospel writers include prior to that final Passover. So at this point, I would like to go back to Matthew. Let's pick it up since I was in Matthew a while ago. We can use Matthew's account. If we go back to Matthew chapter 21, look at the other things that took place that are recorded by Matthew and the other gospel writers that John does not describe. Now, John gives us more of that final Passover very clearly, and we typically go over much of the book of John and those chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, some of those things at the Passover service. But the other gospel writers add other things that John doesn't. So here we're back in Matthew chapter 21. Look at verse 12. Verse 12, Matthew 21 and verse 12, it says, then, after he came into Jerusalem riding on this donkey, then Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you've made it a den of thieves. And he healed people, the next verse says as well. So he cleanses the temple. Now this seems to have been the second time that he did it. You go back in the gospel accounts and you read that when his ministry began that he cleansed the temple. He cleared it out of the money changers and those who bought and sold and made it a place of profit. He said that's not what the temple is supposed to be about. But you've turned it into nothing but a profit-making machine for you. And he did this again apparently at the end of his ministry. Drove them out and cleansed it. And this is right before he was, seems to be the second time. Now in verse 15, it says, but when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children crying out in the temple saying, Hosanna to the Son of David. So people were obviously crying out. They were chanting this in the background as he's healing people, as he's doing these things. And this just infuriates the chief priests and the scribes. It says they were indignant, the end of verse 15. In verse 16, and they said to him, do you hear what these people are saying? And Jesus said to them, yes. Have you never read out of the mouths of babes and nursing infants? You have perfected praise. Then he left them and went out of the city to Bethany, and he lodged there. So they wanted Jesus to quiet the people. And Jesus said, yeah, I hear it. I hear it, and it's right. You begin to get a sense of how much confrontation there was between Jesus and the scribes and the Pharisees and the chief priests in these last few days. But what I wanted to point out is verse 17. It says he left them and he went out of the city to Bethany and there he lodged there. So apparently he goes back to the house of Lazarus and Mary and Martha and spent the night again. And then he would come into the temple and we read this happening a couple of times that he would go and lodge and come into the temple and teach, and then he would go back to the Mount of Olives, to the little town of Bethany, to spend the night. The next morning, we find that he heads back to the temple. In verse 18, he was hungry, and he looks for something to eat on this fig tree. Verse 18, in the morning, he returned to the city, he was hungry, and seeing a fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it but leaves. And he said to it, let no fruit grow on you ever again. And immediately the fig tree withered away. Now the other gospel writers say, Matthew kind of writes in the immediate sense and the immediate concept where it may have been a day before the disciples realized, or later that night when they came back and realized that that fig tree had begun to wither and that it was dying because Jesus Christ in that sense had pronounced a curse on it. I went and checked my fig tree this morning. There are leaves coming out. I also found one little fig. Tiny, tiny, tiny little fig. So I'm not going to dig it up. It survived the winter, so it gets to live. But it just struck me that no figs. He said, this is a time it ought to have figs. There ought to be something on here. There's nothing for me to eat. So he cursed it. Now, what do we learn from this? Well, I think there are a couple of clear points. We're told New Testament Christians in many places, we're told that we're supposed to bear fruit. Draw the analogy to this fig tree. Are we bearing fruit? As we come to Passover, are we asking ourselves, am I bearing fruit as a Christian? Am I producing what God wants me to produce? Am I becoming more like Jesus Christ? Or am I less like Jesus Christ this year than I was last year? If we stop bearing fruit, where does that leave us? Well, I think it leaves us in not a good spot. Now, secondly, I think another lesson from this that's very obvious is the response of the disciples is about faith. They said, wow, look at this. You just say, wither, let there be no fruit anymore from you, and it starts to wither away. Man, what kind of faith is that? Give us more faith. Help us. And Jesus Christ begins to talk about faith. He connects it to their lack of faith and points out that we need to pray in faith. Faith that God hears us. Faith that God knows what we need. Faith that God will listen to our requests. Now, of course, faith that he will answer in the way that he knows is best for us. We want the answer to always be yes. I want the answer to all my prayers to be yes. Yes, Ken, I hear you. I'll do that. But I got to tell you, it doesn't always happen that way. And it doesn't always happen the way I think is the best way. Now, I've learned that if I give it a little time, I'll finally come to see God's way is the best way. After all, maybe it's not the way I think it ought to go. But the point is, God says we have to ask according to his will. In fact, didn't we find Jesus saying, or don't we find him saying that the night before he's betrayed? Not my will, but your will, Father. I don't want to be stubborn and say it's got to be my way or the highway or my way or nothing. I want it your way. I think there's a great lesson in that, in asking in faith, but also asking according to God's will. Now notice, as we come back to the end of this, after he says in verse 22, whatever you ask in prayer, believing, you'll receive. Verse 23, now when he came to the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people confronted him as he was teaching. And said, by what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority? What right do you have to come into the temple and teach people? I mean, you're saying things like you have the right and the authority to teach people these things, and things that are somewhat different than what we've said. Now, Jesus didn't answer their question directly. He said, I'll ask you a question also. And if you give me an answer, then I'll give you an answer about what authority I have. And he asked them about John the Baptist's baptism. Was it from man or was it from God? And when the leaders discussed it among themselves and realized they were in a pickle, because if they responded that it was of God, he'd say, well, why didn't you listen to him? He was a servant of God, and you didn't respond to him. You didn't change. You didn't repent. So they answered, well, we really can't say. And he said, okay, well, then I say, I can't tell you either what authority I have to do this. So he didn't answer them. Now, what happened next was he gave a parable, actually several parables. He gave a parable about two sons, and the father gave them a job. He said, I want you to go do this. One son says, sure, Dad, I'll go do it. But he was lazy and did nothing. Had the right words, but no follow-through, no commitment, no following through on what he was supposed to do. The other son said, no, but he got pricked in his conscience and said, I shouldn't do this. I really should do what Dad asked me to do. And he went and did it. And Jesus said, okay, which one did the will of his father? And they responded, well, obviously it's the one that did what the father asked. The one who had the follow through, not the one that had the words but didn't do it. And then Jesus talked about harlots and publicans. Those who had recognized John as God's servant and repented said, well, they'll go into the kingdom before you. That was a pretty pointed statement to them. He followed that with another parable about a landowner who built a vineyard. He leased it out while he went to a long journey. And he sent back his servants as he was gone to try to collect what was due to him as the landowner. And they wouldn't pay it. In fact, they mistreated his servants. Eventually, he sent his son to collect what was due, and the tenants beat the servants, and they killed the son. Jesus said, well, now, when that owner comes back, what's he going to do to those people? What's he going to do to those tenants? And they said, things aren't going to go well for them at all. I mean, those tenants, he's going to be in a world of hurt. And it didn't take long before the end of the story comes, and we can pick it up in verse 45. The end of chapter 21 says, now when the chief priests and the Pharisees heard these parables, they perceived that he was speaking of them. It dawned on them, both those parables he just gave make us the bad guys. We're the ones that didn't do what God sent John to tell people to do. We didn't repent. We weren't baptized. We're not the ones who do. We're the ones who tell other people to do and don't do. As Jesus said about them in another couple of chapters. Imagine how upset they were. They perceived he was speaking of them, and when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitudes because they took him for a prophet. They wanted to grab him right then and there. And then their reasoning interfered, kind of kicked in and said, you know, if we do that, these people might stone us. They look at him as a prophet. So they didn't want to do it. But imagine how angry they must have been. It only stoked their fury even more to realize that they were the bad guys in both of these parables. And from then on, the arrest was an ongoing effort. They were looking to trip him up, figure some way that they could trip him up. And then we find that in chapter 22. They ask whether it's lawful to pay tithes or taxes or tithes. And he answered, both. Yeah, it's lawful to pay your tithes. You need to pay your tithes, but you also need to pay your taxes. They tried to trip him up about the resurrection. They had this elaborate what-if scenario. Okay, there's this woman and she marries a man and he's got, you know, there's seven brothers and he dies and his next brother marries her and then he dies and the next brother marries her. The levirate marriage of the Old Covenant, Old Testament, Israel, so that there would be land to be inherited by that family. And eventually she's married to all of them. And who's she going to be married to in the resurrection? And Jesus said, you don't know what you're talking about. In the resurrection, people don't marry. They're like the angels. So they couldn't trip him up with that one. They thought he could. They could. A Pharisee lawyer asked him, what's the greatest commandment? Thinking, here's a good way to trip him up. I'll get him to commit to say there's only one. And then I'll say, well, okay, you missed this one, this one, this one, this one. This one. We'll get him. And Jesus gave him two, actually. Love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself, which sum up the Ten Commandments. So Jesus answered very wisely with all of them. When we look at the end of chapter 22, that many of you said, okay, he's going to go through a whole week. He's no way he's going to make it through all those chapters, okay? I'm not reading it all, right? I'm giving a synopsis. So let's come to the end of chapter 22. We find in Matthew chapter 22 and verse 46, it says, and no one was able to answer him a word. They couldn't trip him up. Nor, from that day on, did anyone dare question him anymore. Okay, that's it. We give up. Pharisees can't figure out a way to trip him up. Sadducees can't figure a way. Priests can't figure out a way. Lawyers can't figure out a way to trip him up. He always seems to have an answer. So they quit trying. Decided they better try another tact. Now, Matthew 23 follows this, and I am not going to read Matthew 23, but I will just tell you that it is a railing indictment of the Jewish leadership of that day. Scribes, Sadducees, priests, Pharisees. He specifically talks about the Pharisees, but he's really addressing, in a sense, all of them, the ruling Jewish religious leaders of the day. He attacks them for their hypocrisy, their prideful self-exaltation, their burdensome additions to God's law that make God's law a burden to people instead of the joy that it should be. All of the things that they were doing that he said are not what God intended. You mistreat God's people. You put a weight around God's people's neck and says, this is what you have to do if you want a right relationship with God. They ended up mistreating his servants, in fact, killing his prophets. And Jesus condemned them for all of these things. It was after this that he left the temple. And at that point, we come to chapter 24. Verse 1 tells us that he went out, he departed from the temple. And at this point, it's the disciples come up and say, well, no, wait, look at the magnificence of this temple. Look at what has been built by Herod. Well, all those years of work rebuilding the temple. What a beautiful mount this is. What a beautiful temple mount. What a beautiful facility has been created here. It's an awesome thing with this temple, with all of the buildings that are around it. The magnificence of the temple buildings. And Jesus ends up giving them the Olivet prophecy of the events leading up to his return and right after his return. Very involved prophecy that takes all of Matthew chapter 24. It leads all the way up to the time of his return. In Matthew 25, there are a couple of parables that follow on the heels of that instruction about his return and what leads up to his return. We have the parable about the 10 virgins. We have the parable of the talents. Several parables in that chapter, chapter 25. So we see how things are leading up very quickly to his betrayal and death. All of his teaching was in the temple. And he would come to the temple at the end date, and he would go back to Bethany at night. And the Jewish leaders were getting more and more irritated and angry and furious at him because of what he was teaching. He exposed the religious leaders for the frauds that they were, claiming to be the spokesman of God, teaching God's way, and yet looking to murder the Son of God. What horrible irony there is in that. Claiming to speak for God, and yet harboring murder in their hearts. Now, some people look at the Jewish leadership of that day and say, well, those are the worst human beings there ever was. But you know what? You're just like any other human being. I would say if every one of us looks deep in our heart, you and I, without God's Spirit, which they didn't have, without God's Spirit, we'd be just like them. That's the way human beings are when they are given power. It's a heady thing. And it's something that Satan deeply, deeply desired, and he fought to take from God a leadership position. And if we examine ourselves carefully, I think we'll find that we would be just like them if we didn't have God's Spirit and if we didn't allow God's Spirit to guide us. It's a very important thing for any leader to allow God's Spirit to lead you, to not fight it, but to follow it and submit. Very important point. Now, if we keep with the events in Matthew, we'll see we're just a few days from the crucifixion at this point. As we go through Matthew chapter 25, we come to the end of that, chapter 26. Verse 1 tells us, came to pass when Jesus had, this is verse 1 of Matthew 26, it came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings that he said to his disciples, you know that after 2 days is the Passover, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified. He's speaking very plainly. 2 days from now is Passover. I'm going to be delivered up, and I'm going to be crucified. In verse 3, the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, it's called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and to kill him. It's here that Matthew, Mark, and Luke place Mary pouring the costly oil on Jesus' feet. I mentioned earlier we'd come back to that. They place it here 2 days before the Passover, where John places it earlier. He places it 6 days before the Passover. And some have looked at that and said, well, maybe there were two instances of that. But I'd like to point out, as many scholars have said, all of the New Testament writers did not always write in chronological order. Many times they grouped it according to topic. And it seems that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, more than likely are the ones that put this according to topic, placed it together, showing this sort of as a tipping point for Judas, that they were assembled, they were plotting how to take him, they wanted to trick him, they wanted to kill him, they wanted to figure out some way to get rid of Jesus Christ. And John points out that example was the tipping point. It was Judas who was very, very angry about what was going to happen. And so he agrees with the Jewish leaders to betray Jesus Christ. We find that in Matthew 26, verse 14, says, then one of the 12 called Judas Iscariot went to the chief priests and he said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? What will you give me? Talk about a get frame of mind. Remember an older man who used to talk about two ways of life, get and give? God's way is a way of giving, it's a way of sharing, it's a way of compassion and care for other people. And Satan's way is a way of get. And guess whose way Judas was living by right now? What are you going to give me? What do I get if I betray him to you? How can I profit from this? How will it help me? And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. Now that's prophetic also. Go to the Old Testament and you'll find that the 30 pieces of silver is prophesied as what the price that they would pay for him. And verse 16, so from that time they sought an opportunity to, he sought an opportunity to betray him. In verse 17, notice we come to verse 17. It says, now at the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying to him, where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? So now we're right next to the Passover. And this is one of those passages, one of those statements that gives modern Christianity a chance to trip up and think the wrong thing and come to the wrong conclusion. And they do. They stumble on this. Notice the day of the feast is all in italics in the King James and the New King James. It just says literally on the first of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus. It's added by the translators. They looked at what was being said here and assumed that it was the Passover was being killed on the night that began the first day of unleavened bread because of the wording, because of the general wording in the Greek. I went through Passover controversies in a Bible study about this time last year. It's on the local website. If you have any questions and want to go back and review it, you're certainly welcome to do so. But historical evidence shows us that the Sadducees were keeping the Passover at the beginning of the 14th, and the Pharisees were keeping it at the end of the 14th, the beginning of the 15th, the beginning of the first day of unleavened bread. You've got that in historical record. When the temple was destroyed in AD 70, the Sadducees basically lost all power. They ceased to exist as a group. And so what became normative Judaism were the Pharisees, the ones who were keeping Passover later in the afternoon and the early evening following the day of Passover, following the 14th, keeping it the beginning of the 15th. There's a lot of evidence that Passover and unleavened bread were spoken of as one of the pilgrim feasts, and many times it was referred to together. Those 8 days, Passover and the 7 days of unleavened bread, they were referred to as one feast, sometimes called Passover, sometimes called Days of Unleavened Bread. A lot of evidence on that. They're just back-to-back. They are two distinct feasts, but they're back-to-back, just like Feast of Tabernacles and the eighth day, or the last great day. They're two feasts, separate feasts, but they're back-to-back. One day follows after the other seven. In this case, one day precedes the next seven. Two separate festivals back-to-back. Notice Luke's statement about the same time. Luke chapter 22. Let's go to Luke. Luke 22 is the one we'll read. Luke chapter 21 is the Olivet prophecy. And then in chapter 22, Luke chapter 22 and verse 1, look at the way Luke phrases it. And we can see from Luke's phrasing that he considered all of this, and again, since one festival, one pilgrimage festival, but he identifies that there are two aspects to it. And there are actually two separate feasts. Luke chapter 22 and verse 1 says, "Now the Feast of Unleavened Bread drew near, which is called Passover." So Luke correctly identifies Passover as, Passover as a part of that time period. It's the Passover, but it's this time period of Days of Unleavened Bread. And we notice in verse 7, if we skip down, it says, "Then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed." Again, during that time period of that pilgrimage festival when the Passover has to be killed. "And he sent Peter and John, saying, 'Go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat.'" So again, the feasts are lumped together, and Jesus instructs Peter and John to go prepare the Passover before he's betrayed and before he is crucified. Now again, I won't go over the events, and I won't go through all the details today. But it's easy to show that this was a distinct feast, and it was a night before Christ was crucified that he was betrayed, and it is the night before that he kept his final Passover. I won't go through all the details of his final Passover and the instructions, the betrayal, the beating, the crucifixion. We cover some of that at Passover night. So let's move forward in Luke. We're here in Luke. I'd like to go to Luke as we come to Luke 24. Actually, hang on. Let's go to Luke. Looks like I did not write the scripture down. It's Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23 and verses 46 and 47. We find the actual death of Christ in the crucifixion. It says, "When Jesus had cried out with a loud voice," this is Luke 23, verse 46, "when he had cried out with a loud voice, he said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' Having said this, he breathed his last. So when the centurion saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, 'Certainly, this was a righteous man.'" This was a righteous man. It's interesting that this centurion could see what the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the chief priests could not see. He was a righteous man. And this centurion recognized that. Luke tells us about Joseph. He was a good council member. who did not agree with the crucifixion. He was overridden by the rest of the majority of the council, but he didn't agree with it. And he goes to Pilate and he asks for the body to be buried. We can pick it up in verse 52. It says, "This man went to Pilate. He asked for the body of Jesus. And when he took it down, he wrapped it in linen, laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of the rock where no one had ever lain before." That day, when Jesus died and when he was laid in the tomb, that day was the preparation and the Sabbath drew near. That day was a preparation. It was a day before a Sabbath. Modern Christianity is certain that this is speaking of the weekly Sabbath. They always say he was crucified on Friday. You might find some small groups here and there, but generally most of modern Christianity is going to tell you this is a weekly Sabbath that is drawing near, and Jesus was buried on a Friday afternoon. Notice what John tells us, that it's something very different than that. John chapter 19. If we go back to the book of John and pick it up here after the death of Jesus Christ, the crucifixion is in chapter 19 and verses 30 and 31. It says, "So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, 'It is finished,' and bowing his head, he gave up the spirit. Therefore, because it was a preparation day that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken, that they might be taken away, that they might die faster, die more quickly, and be taken off the cross and buried before sundown." But notice that Sabbath was not a regular Sabbath. It was not a weekly Sabbath. It was not a seventh-day Sabbath. That day was a high Sabbath. In fact, it was the first high Sabbath of the year, the first holy day in God's festival plan. The festivals that he lists in Leviticus chapter 23. The first high day, the first holy day, is the first day of unleavened bread. And just like a weekly Sabbath, it is a commanded assembly of God's people. Regardless of what day of the week it falls on, God commands us to assemble on every Sabbath, but he also commands us on the high Sabbaths, on the holy days that we are to assemble to worship him. And that particular year, since Passover was on a Wednesday, at Wednesday night, it became the first day of unleavened bread at sundown, and that year it was on a Thursday. Notice Luke tells us the women noted where he was buried. They wanted to see where he was buried. He wanted to know exactly where that was. Then they obviously rested on that holy day, the 15th of the first month, which is the first day of unleavened bread. And then they prepared spices and fragrant oils. Now, that was a big job that would have taken hours for them to do. But look at Luke. Let's go back to Luke's account, kind of bouncing back and forth between these. But Luke chapter 23. In verses 55 and 56, it says, "And the women who had come with him," Luke 23 and verse 55, "the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment." Now, they would not have prepared the spices and fragrant oils on the high holy day. It would not have been something that they would have done on that day. They would have prepared them on a day other than the holy day. Notice Mark. We put Mark's account with this. Look in Mark chapter 16. We've said many times the Bible is a book of addition. It's not subtraction. You don't take one and delete everything else. You add them all together and you get the full picture. Here it's very clear that they returned and prepared spices and oils and then rested on a Sabbath day. Look what Mark chapter 16 and verse 1 tells us. The last verse of the previous verse shows about, the last couple of verses show that he was put in the tomb. Mary Magdalene and the Mary of mother of Joseph observed where he was laid. And verse 16, "When the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Salome bought spices that they might come and anoint him." So they bought the spices and prepared them after the Sabbath. And then they rested. Let's go to Matthew's account as well. We may as well go to Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28. It says, "Now after the Sabbath, As the first day of the week began to dawn, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came to the tomb. And the Greek word here for Sabbath is plural. The other gospel accounts don't use the plural, they use the singular. But Matthew uses the plural, a sabbaton. It is a plural word. You can look it up in lexicons or interlinears, but it is a plural form of the word Sabbath. It means there were two Sabbaths. There was a Sabbath right after Jesus was laid in the tomb. At the end of that Sabbath, Mary and the other ladies bought and prepared spices, and they rested on the Sabbath. And after the Sabbaths, plural, one on Thursday, one on the weekly Sabbath, then, the first day of the week, they came to the tomb. The only way you could rest on the Sabbath after buying them after the Sabbath was to have those two Sabbaths close together, like they were, a Thursday and then a Saturday. Hence the plural use of the word here in Matthew chapter 28. AD 31, with an annual Sabbath, first day of unleavened bread on Thursday, on a weekly Sabbath on the Sabbath, fits these verses correctly. Then the Marys came back to the tomb very early on Sunday, and Jesus Christ was already risen. For those of you that saw the Friday Night Live last night or watched that, Mr. Black mentioned when he talked about was Jesus Christ real, the fact that the testimony of women is included is pretty instructive. Because in the first century, women could not give testimony in court. It wasn't accepted. Their word was worth nothing in terms of a court of law. The fact that in that first century, the gospel writers would say, it was women who went first and saw that he wasn't there and came and reported it. And on their word, Peter and John ran to the tomb. And sure enough, their word was accurate. It's a pretty good indication that this is not made up stuff. This is not clever, fictitious writing. They wouldn't have written it, having women being the ones to first discover his body missing. It would have been somebody else. It would have been some man. But he was not in the tomb. He was already gone. It says an angel had come, and there was a great earthquake. An angel had come, and he was rolled back the stone, and he was sitting there when they came to look in Matthew, or Matthew's account. May as well follow it there. Sat there, looked, watched. His countenance was like lightning, his clothes like white as snow. The guards shook with fear, became like dead men. But verse 5, it says, the angel answered and said to the women, don't be afraid, for I know you seek Jesus who was crucified. He's not here. He's risen. I mean, he's already gone. You're looking for someone. He's long gone. He's not here. Come, you can see where he was laying. But go and tell his disciples that he's risen from the dead, and indeed he's going before you into Galilee. There you will see him. Behold, I have told you. So he wasn't in the tomb. They didn't see him rise. They didn't see him come to life. They didn't see him come out of the tomb. He was already gone when they got there, very early in the first light of Sunday morning. He was already gone. Now, we know that from the Old Testament, Passover was supposed to be kept. In fact, let's go back to Exodus chapter 12. Passover and unleavened bread are right next to each other. Again, I won't spend a lot of time on this. Spent some time last year in that Bible study. But in verses 5 and 6, we find that they were to keep that lamb up to the 14th day. In verse 6, that lamb, you keep it to the 14th day of the same month, and the whole assembly is to kill it at twilight. The Hebrew actually literally says between the evenings, so it's between sundown and darkness. And they'll take some of the blood, put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they're going to eat. We skip down to verse 11. It says, and thus you shall eat it with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand. You shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I'll pass through the land of Egypt on that night. Same night when they killed the lamb, when they ate the meal, they were to keep that blood on their doorposts, and God was going to pass through that land on the night of Passover and strike the firstborn of the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute that judgment. I am God. I am the Lord. So Passover was observed at the start of the 14th, because on the 14th, on Passover, he was going to go through the land and kill the firstborn. The next night, the following night, begins the 15th, which is the first day of unleavened bread, Leviticus chapter 23. Again, just hitting highlights on this. Leviticus chapter 23, as we read about Passover, that it is the 14th, it is not the 15th. Leviticus 23, verse 5, on the 14th day of the first month, at twilight, is the Lord's Passover. It begins the day. That's when the Passover begins, the day of Passover, at night that begins the day. That is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it, but you shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days. The seventh day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. So Passover is observed at the start of the 14th. You have Passover day. Then you have the first day of unleavened bread beginning with the night that begins the 15th. And you have 7 days of unleavened bread. Now, questions come up all the time about leavening and about what is leavening and what has to be put out and what doesn't have to be put out. And over the years, we've made it very clear that this is a day of days of unleavened bread. Not drinks, but bread. Somebody's smiling at me. Yeah, you can drink beer during the days of unleavened bread. Yes, it has yeast in it. And you know what? If somebody was really determined to use a beer to make bread rise, I suppose they could do it. Not a very converted thing to do, a very unconverted thing to do. And a converted Christian wouldn't do that. But they probably could. They could figure out some way to do that. But it's not wrong to drink beer because the focus is on bread, not beer. In fact, the latest personal correspondence letter we have on it talks about kefir as well. Kefir is a fermented drink. And technically, you could use kefir, I suppose. Again, somebody could get very ingenious about that and figure out a way to make bread rise with it. If you use it for that purpose, it's wrong, but just to drink it isn't a problem because it's a liquid. It's not bread. The focus is bread and what kind of bread we eat. See, the whole point of it is leavening agents that are used to spread their puffing up ability throughout the dough so that the dough is actually changed. It's made different and the bread rises. That makes it a perfect example of sin or a symbol of sin. That it spreads through our human thoughts and spreads to others. I'll be happy to share that letter with anyone if you have questions or talk with you if you would like. But the point is, there are 7 days of unleavened bread, and they follow the day of Passover. They begin with that sundown. Now, since we talked about the Passover, or rather the resurrection here, we kind of got onto something else. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 12. We noted that the Marys came to the tomb early in the morning on Sunday morning, and he was already risen. He was already gone. And the angel told them, he's gone. He's not here. If we go back to Matthew chapter 12, notice what Jesus Christ said about himself, beginning in verse 38. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 38 says, "Then some of the scribes and the Pharisees answered, saying, 'Teacher, we want a sign from you. Give us some kind of a sign that you're the Messiah. You talk about being from God. You do all these other miracles. Give us some kind of a sign. What can you do? Do something special for us.' But he answered and said to them, 'An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign.'" Ooh, that's pretty bad for people who look for signs, isn't it? You don't need signs. You listen to God. You pray to God. You ask him for guidance. You let his Holy Spirit lead you and direct you. But he said, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." Now some look at that and they say, well, in the Old Testament, there was kind of a Hebrew colloquial saying, 3 days, 3 nights, 3 days, didn't necessarily mean a full 3 days and 3 nights. But the fact that in the in the New Testament, he specifically says, as he was 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights. In Greek, there is no such saying. It literally means 3 full days and 3 full nights. He said, that's the only sign I'm going to give you, that I am the Messiah. And again, modern Christianity misses the sign. They insist that he went into the tomb right before the Sabbath, right before Saturday on a Friday night, and that he arose early in the morning on Sunday morning. But that's not 3 days and three nights. There's no way you can fit 3 days and three nights in that time period. Now, I've read a lot of things about how people try to squeeze 3 days and three nights. Some of them try to say, well, it's a colloquial saying or just kind of a general idea like it was in the Old Testament in Hebrew, but that's not true in Greek. It's not right. I read an interesting one yesterday that I'd never seen before. This man took the argument that, well, heart of the earth doesn't mean heart of the earth. Just reporting. It doesn't mean heart of the earth. It means under the control of the Romans or of the Jews and the Romans. So because he was captured the night at the beginning or during the night of Passover, you get to count that night as a full night. And you get to count Passover day as a day and the next night. And so you can squeeze in 3 days and three nights and get him rising on Sunday morning. I'd never heard that one before. That was kind of different. I thought, heart of the earth doesn't mean heart of the earth. I thought it does, but anyway, that was his argument. But there's no way, really, to say that. There's no way that it can work. He went in the grave. If he went in on a Wednesday evening, because Thursday was a holy day, Wednesday evening, that night, all day Thursday, that was day one, all Thursday night, all day Friday was day two, all Friday night, all day Saturday was the third day and the third night, and just as he was put in the grave right before sundown on Wednesday, he would have been raised Saturday, right at sundown, right before sundown. It's the only way. It's exactly 3 days and three nights. And when they came Sunday morning, he was long gone. He wasn't there. It's the only sign he gave of being the Messiah, being our Savior. It makes it very important. I hope this review has been helpful to you, reminding you of some things or helping you maybe think of, learn some things you didn't know. But what do we do with this information? What do we do with realizing what the Bible actually says? Do we get gloat about knowing something that others don't? We get puffed up and proud about it? Well, that sure would be out of sync with the many other set of festivals, wouldn't it? Passover and unleavened bread, certainly we don't do that. It would be a wrong way. It would be a wrong spirit. I think what we should do is be tremendously thankful to God for sharing His truth with us, for preserving it, for letting us read it and let the Bible tell us what He means. Let Him tell us what it says and accept what it says. I think we also need to follow the instruction of three passages. I'd like to close with these, three specific scriptures about this time of year, and I'll close with these and these points. First of all, 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Paul was not someone who was there at the time of Christ's crucifixion and resurrection. He was not one of the followers of Jesus Christ. In fact, we read of him as Saul after the New Testament church was established. We find he's someone who's going out trying to get Christians, trying to persecute Christians, trying to put them in prison and punish them until God converted him. And he called himself someone called out of season or born out of season, like someone born out of season. But he tells us what he received from Jesus Christ. What Jesus Christ taught him is being relayed here to the church in Corinth. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning in verse 23, says, "For I received from the Lord," that's from Jesus Christ himself, "that which I also delivered to you, that the night on which in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.' For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. Whoever drinks or eats this bread and drinks this cup in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of Christ. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. We're to keep the Passover the same night that Jesus Christ did, the night in which he was betrayed. The next day he was crucified and put in the tomb before the first day of unleavened bread. So we keep the Passover at the beginning of the day of Passover, and we're commanded to keep it. Examine ourselves, but we're commanded to keep the Passover. Take those symbols. John chapter 13. John chapter 13. Another instruction, this one specifically from Jesus Christ. Paul tells us he passed on to them, and therefore to us, what Jesus Christ had specifically taught him. And here we find John's record of Jesus' statement on that final Passover. After he had washed the disciples' feet, in verse 14, he says, "If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he that is sent greater than him who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." So we're to do what Jesus Christ did. We're to wash one another's feet at Passover. We're to follow through on that. The word blessed, the Greek word, could also be translated as happy. We're blessed, we're happy, if we follow Christ's example, if we do as he did. And finally, John chapter 14 and verse 15. Very concise statement, yet a very important statement from Jesus Christ. John chapter 14 and verse 15. "If you love me, keep my commandments." If we love God, if we love Jesus Christ, we're to keep his commandments. That means the ones he thundered from Mount Sinai, Ten Commandments. Those things that he gave years and years ago, thousands of years ago, including his feasts and the other instructions he gave for godly living. If we do these things, we will be blessed and happy. We can have great peace of mind.